signs to start taking it. I think that's very important. And because many people with diabetes may, you know, it increases their risk for Alzheimer's and vascular dementia, I believe that lipoic acid could be very, I think it could be very important. It also
Dr. Lodog,
like lead and mercury, which also is, you know, intriguing.
We're out of time, but it was a pleasure having you back on the show.
Thank you so much.
We're talking today to Dr. Tirone Lodog about her latest book from National Geographic, Fortify Your Life. You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Stay tuned for the rest of the Monday Morning Radio Zine.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Community Acupuncture and Massage, a benefit for political prisoner Mutulu Shakur, Sunday, February the 7th, noon to 4 p.m. at 7 Star Acupuncture in Portland. Dr. Mutulu Shakur was one of the founders of the Black Acupuncture Advisory Association in North America and the Harlem Institute of Acupuncture. Incarcerated for 30 years, Mutulu and his legal team are seeking community and financial support to fight his imprisonment. A group of licensed acupuncturists and massage therapists are offering treatments to our community as a fundraiser. Again, that's of Community Acupuncture and Massage, a benefit for political prisoner Mutulu Shakur, Sunday, February the 7th, noon to 4 p.m. at 7 Star Acupuncture, 436 Southeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Laura Delano. Laura Delano is a psychiatric survivor and activist, and she's diagnosed with bipolar at age 14 and has taken medications for more than 10 years. For the past 2 years, she has been medication-free. She is a peer specialist working in a mental health agency in Massachusetts, and she's also a blogger on the website madinamerica.com. which is published by Robert Whitaker. So we're going to be speaking about medications and coming off medications. Thank you for joining me on Madness Radio, Laura Delano.
Hey, Will. It's great to be here.
I'm really happy to have you on the show, Laura. I've been really impressed by your work, and I really want to encourage people to check out your blog posts at the madinamerica.com website. And you're basically telling your whole story, and this is part of a larger writing project that you're doing, talking about your experiences with the psychiatric system.
I've only written my stories up through 2010 before I actually even began to come off of psychiatric drugs. Life has gotten busy, which is definitely nothing I'm complaining about, so I haven't been able to write as often. But I do plan to expand the blog into a bigger writing project that, you know, it's in its early stages. I felt compelled to share my story because I don't think it's unique by any means. I just think it's, the more we can speak out about surviving these experiences, the more hope it will inspire in other people to do the same.
Well, I want to really focus in this interview on your experiences with coming off and your whole recovery process and how you moved out of psychiatric care after being diagnosed and being part of, you were taking medications for more than 10 years, it sounds like.
Yeah, I was first medicated at age 14, and it was such a profound existential insult is how I kind of talk about it or think about it.
An existential insult.
I wrote that somewhere. I can't remember where, but it's really what it felt like. The first time I was diagnosed, it just, you know, I was having a tough enough time as that was. And then to have that label, the label bipolar disorder put on me, I felt so alone. I felt completely separated from all of humanity. And then when they told me I needed to take, initially I was put on Depakote and Prozac. I was angry and I basically said, screw you.
And so how did this start? What was going on at age 14 that the doctors would say, oh, you're a bipolar teenager?
I was having a lot of intense anger and rage. You know, the way I make sense of it now is I was hitting puberty and I was really confused about a lot of things. And I didn't have a good relationship to my emotions as it was. I'd always tried to push emotions that I found uncomfortable. I'd always try to push them down. And I think it just got to a boiling point, basically. And so I had a lot of anger and rage, especially at home. You know, people at school didn't see it, but my family really saw it. And when I was brought to a psychiatrist, they told me that the anger was a sign of mania.
Did they ask you what you were angry about or what was going on, or it was just immediately seen as a symptom of this disorder?
I can't remember the exact timeline, but it was definitely in the very initial stages of seeing a psychiatrist that I was diagnosed. But I always remember targeting my anger at basically everything around me, like my family, my school, my town. You know, now I realize that it was just all in my own internal stuff. But I think that's kind of the way I talked about it with doctors. But it felt so uncontrollable, the anger that I experienced. And I think that's why they said, you know, this is more than typical teenage angst, because it felt like, I felt like I was possessed. You know, I felt like kind of a Jekyll and Hyde.
You were very resistant to the medication at age 14, and you didn't really take it consistently.
No, I didn't. I think I'd take it here and there, but I used to hide it in little, you know, boxes in my closet, or I'd throw it down the sink. I definitely did not take it regularly.
Do you think if you had taken the medication consistently, it would have been a good thing?
I'm so glad that I did not take the medication consistently during those years, because those were some of my most formative years, you know, physically and psychologically and emotionally, being a teenager. I think it's safe to say that those medications, had I taken them regularly, would have just propelled me further and further downward in a faster way. I mean, maybe when people say medications help, the word help is such an interesting one, because what does that really mean? You know, maybe my emotions would have been dulled and numbed, but is that really helping? To me, I see that as not helping. And I did for many years think that that was helpful, because I felt so uncomfortable with my feelings that I'd rather not feel them at all. But I don't see that as help in any way.
So it sounds like for 4 years you didn't take the medications. You were really against that. And then something happened when you were 18. Things just started to get too much. And then you decided to go ahead and say, well, yeah, okay, I believe you. I am bipolar. Is that what happened?
It was my freshman year in college, and I felt so lost in my life. You know, having a lot of thoughts of suicide, of just not being alive anymore, I was feeling completely separated from all other people. I felt misunderstood. I felt, you know, and worst of all, I didn't even understand myself. This is how I thought about it at the time. Mm-hmm. Something is seriously wrong with me, and I have tried everything to get better, and it's not working. It must be something medical. There must be something biologically wrong with me. And that's when I finally said, yep, I need to go to a psychiatrist.
And what you said is such a common experience. People reach this point of desperation and they say, I've tried everything. They must be right. It must be a medical problem. I think I do need to see myself as bipolar. I do need to see myself as someone who needs medications. This is a biological issue. What would you say to yourself now, if you could go back in time to that 18-year-old Laura, when she's facing that desperation and she's right at the point of saying, yes, I do need these medications. Yes, I do need to see myself as bipolar. What would you say to yourself?
I would definitely say to myself, you're a human being just like every other human being around you. You're not abnormal. You're not broken. You're not dysfunctional. You're not diseased. You're feeling emotions, which are human things, and you're feeling them in intense ways.
So Laura, you didn't get that advice, and you really felt like the only place to turn was to medications and a diagnosis of bipolar. So what happened when you took that decision and went that path?
Right after that first appointment with the new psychiatrist, I actually felt some incredibly powerful, beautiful, positive feelings. And it felt amazing, because I hadn't felt those things in such a long time. I felt a sense of hope, felt a sense of faith. I felt optimistic. I actually have a very powerful memory of my heart just pounding with exhilaration. And I remember the walk back to the bus stop after leaving the hospital where my psychiatrist, you know, where his office was. I truly believed that everything was going to be okay and that they were going to fix me. And that's how I thought about it in my head. They are going to fix me. I am going to be okay. I don't remember how long that sense of hope lasted, because for the next 9.5 years, my life went darker, deeper, further down.
So you were on 19 different medications over the more than 10 years. You were on psych drugs, and at the end, they had you on a mood stabilizer, an antidepressant, an anti-anxiety drug, and sounds like 2 antipsychotics.
Yep. I always had this impression that the more medications there were, the more quote-unquote sophisticated the med regimen was. You know, I remember almost, it sounds so kind of perverse to say it, but I was kind of proud. Like, they were taking a lot of time to really get things right. This was a very sophisticated regimen with very modern drugs. You know, now when I look back on how I had a little pill bag, a little dop kit of pills that I brought with me everywhere I went, it was like they were like my security blanket. I mean, I didn't go anywhere. I didn't go anywhere without my medications.
Well, this is really important, because this is part of one of the things that I think happens to a lot of people, is that you get an extraordinary amount of attention in a way that feels like sophisticated, scientific, authoritative expertise to help fix you and help get your chemistry back to some kind of normal, balanced state. And that can be a really, really powerful thing, especially for a young person to feel like they're getting that kind of attention in a way, it's a support.
And actually, it's funny, because I didn't even realize that Judy Chamberlain had used the same phrase. I hadn't read her piece, but I wrote a piece called Becoming the Good Patient, because it gave my life meaning. It was the only meaning I had in my life, was being a psychiatric patient, was being bipolar. And so I worked really hard at being good at it.
It's a kind of caretaking too. It's like, I imagine you felt very cared for.
I put all my trust in psychiatry. So in that sense, I definitely, you know, I saw myself as being taken care of. I guess I just never actually felt like a sense of calm, a sense of ease, a sense of peace that you'd feel when someone helps take care of you. I never had those feelings.
And so tell us about what the experience was of being on those medications, because it sounds like, I mean, some people may have feel helped, feel supported, and feel like they're really getting some benefit from the medications, but you said it just fueled this downward spiral into darker and darker places. What was it like to be on those medications for 10 years?
I was so profoundly disconnected from myself in every aspect, like in an emotional way, in an existential way, in a physical way. I really felt like I was playing a part in my life. Like I was acting, I was performing. Nothing felt genuine. Now also that I'm getting healthier, I'm moving through the withdrawal today, and my body's getting healthier, I look back now and just see how much of a physical toll my body took from these medications. I had a lot of weight gain, you know, acne, my thyroid stopped functioning from the lithium, so now I have hypothyroidism, I have thyroid disease. I had sexual dysfunction. I was cognitively, I had a hard time concentrating, my memory, I had memory issues. There was just so much going on, and I didn't even realize it because it had become my normal.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, and our guest is Laura Delano. She's a psychiatric survivor who was diagnosed with bipolar disorder at age 14. She's a blogger on madinamerica.com, and she's been medication-free for almost 2 years, and we're speaking about coming off psychiatric drugs. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. And Laura, what did they tell you were the risks of these medications that you were given?
You know, I heard a lot about, you know, you might have headaches, you might have a little bit of trouble getting to sleep, you might have a little bit of constipation, but these usually smooth out in a few weeks as your body adjusts. Oh, I did hear about weight gain for Geodon and Zyprexa and those medications, but I remember always feeling like the potential side effects would settle down in a few weeks. Like I remember always thinking that it would be okay. You know, I might feel it a little bit in the beginning, but my body's going to acclimate and then it'll be okay.
So they really minimize the severity of the risk that you were undertaking by being on these meds long term.
They definitely didn't have an open, candid conversation with me about all of the potentially permanent side effects. They didn't at all. And
what about the suicidal feelings? Because that's something that I know that patients are told quite frequently, that, look, this is a disease, it's life-threatening, you could kill yourself, you better be on these medications, even if they have some unpleasant side effects. How did it affect your suicidal feelings? And what do you make of that claim that, you know, bipolar is so serious that, you know, people need to be on the medications or else they're at risk for suicide?
I definitely bought that belief hook, line, and sinker during all of those years, because I was chronically suicidal throughout my 20s, and I did have a very serious suicide attempt in November of 2008, where it had become such a big part of my life, was thinking about death. And all along, I took that as a symptom of my bipolar, of just how severe my bipolar was. In the weeks leading up to my suicide attempt, I was on, let's see, I had recently been on 400 milligrams of Lamictal, which had given me akathisia. You know, that for people who don't know what that is, it's kind of uncontrolled motor, like my arms were kind of jittering and shaking, and I felt this like very intense energy like vibrating through me. So they had recently decreased me back down to 200 milligrams of Lamictal, and then I was on 30 milligrams of Lexapro, which is a very high dosage of Lexapro, which is an antidepressant. Most people take 10 or 20 milligrams. I was on 30, and I was on 3 milligrams of Klonopin. In the time period leading up to my suicide attempt, I was incredibly, quote-unquote, manic. I wasn't really, the only way I slept was by taking the Klonopin. And also by that time in my life, I was drinking very heavily because the medications for all those years never seemed to work. But, you know, during the day, I felt very manic. That's how I thought about it then. And it really got to a point where I saw no other option than to take my life. Like, I really, it had overtaken me. And, you know, I'm obviously here now, and I'm just so grateful that I'm here, because now that it's given me such a sense of peace, knowing that that might not have been me that wanted to die. It wasn't me. Not that it might. That was not me that wanted to die. That was medicated me.
Laura, how did you start to pull yourself away from the beliefs that you were told about bipolar and needing medication? How did you transition to coming off meds?
Through a series of events, I found myself on a psychiatric unit at a private hospital up in Belmont, Massachusetts. And I had no idea at that time, you know, what was up and what was down and what was left and what was right. I knew I didn't want to die. And I knew that the way I was going, I would die. And I needed something to change, but I had no idea what. And it ended up starting with me realizing that I needed to get sober from alcohol. The last 4 years of my life up until that time, alcohol had really become a daily part of my life. And so getting sober gave me a little bit of mental clarity. You know, I still felt really dark inside, but my life began to feel a little bit more manageable on the outside, and I kind of started to feel a little bit of a momentum. And I just started to think, as my mind got a little bit clearer, like, who are you off of all of these drugs you're on, off of these five medications that you take every day? And I just started to get curious about it. And I was doing an intensive outpatient program for borderline personality disorder, which I'd picked up. I picked up that diagnosis in the later years. So I was going to this hospital every day for treatment. And I started to ask my psychopharmacologist, can I try coming off of these medications? I really want to see who I am off of these. And he pushed back in the beginning, but eventually what ended up happening was that they all met, my treatment team met and determined that maybe the way they said it was that I had been misdiagnosed with bipolar disorder. They basically said, maybe you've been misdiagnosed. You definitely have borderline personality disorder, and you're definitely an alcoholic. But maybe you were misdiagnosed, so we're willing to bring you off of the bipolar medications, but you need to stay on Lamictal because that helps for borderline. At that point, I was kind of like, well, screw you, going to come off of Lamictal too. I didn't tell them that. I did it covertly, but over the next 5 months, I tapered off of those medications.
Do you think that being involved with recovery from alcohol really got you thinking about the connections between the psychiatric medications and the alcohol that you had been consuming?
I mean, I definitely realized that I had really been damaging my body. To be honest, I don't know how I don't have permanent physical damage today from the way I did mix alcohol with all those medications. But it got me thinking. Like, I saw how much I was changing from getting sober, that it gave me a sense of agency. And I was finally kind of realizing that I wanted to be alive and I wanted to have a life for myself, and I wanted to know who I was in that life. And, you know, the most beautiful moment in all of this time was actually when I found Anatomy of an Epidemic, which I accidentally stumbled upon in a bookstore in May of 2010. I think I'd started tapering off, I want to say, in like end of March of 2010. And I found Robert Whitaker's book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, sitting on a bookshelf. And I remember looking at the cover with that human head where the head's broken down into all these little sections, each with the name of a psychiatric drug inside. And I had been on like all of those, every single drug other than Risperdal and I think one other one, I'd been on all of them. I was like, what is this book? I now saw that these medications that I had been taking for treatment might have actually been making me sicker all along. And that was all I needed to just continue on with the withdrawal process, with the tapering process, because it was really hard to come off. It was not an easy thing.
Yeah, tell us about that, because you said at the end you were on five different medications, mood stabilizer, SSRI, antidepressant, antipsychotics. How did you come off your medications?
I came off of the Ativan first, which is a benzodiazepine, and benzodiazepine withdrawal is really horrendous. I had come off of Klonopin back after my suicide attempt. This is kind of going away from the question you just asked, but for those of you out there who might be struggling with benzo withdrawal, I don't think there's anything worse. The physical, emotional, and mental effects from that are really intense.
Yeah, the benzodiazepines are actually more addictive than heroin and can be more dangerous to come off than heroin. A lot of people don't know that. That's Ativan, Valium, Klonopin, Xanax.
That was a really horrendous experience. When I was coming off of benzos, I had absolutely no balance. Like I had no equilibrium. I felt like I had vertigo all the time. My head, the headaches, the migraines were so intense that I wanted to like rip my head open. It was so horrible. I had the cold sweats. It was hell on earth. It was horrible.
It sounds like you did have the support and guidance of your prescriber in this process. But what was it that helped you to make it through this horrendous withdrawal scene that you were in? I mean, was the prescriber helpful with that? How was it that you made it through?
I definitely wouldn't say that the prescriber was supportive emotionally for me. It was really more just he agreed to do it, and he was kind of, it was supportive in the sense that I knew I had a doctor supervising me, but I didn't turn to him for emotional support. I really leaned into the community of people I'd found in getting sober, and you know, I didn't have anyone who had been through psychiatric drug withdrawal specifically, so I didn't have anyone to guide me, to let me know what I might anticipate, what it might look like, how long it might take. But I did have people who were dealing with their own emotional and physical pain, you know, a different type of pain. But at the end of the day, it's the same feelings of anxiety, fear, sadness, anger. I surrounded myself with people who were learning how to live with their feelings and not be isolated and not be shut off. And so I really believe, for me, I don't think I could have done it if I didn't have that type of community. I do have to say as well that my family was so supportive. I was living with my aunt and uncle up here in the Boston area for almost a year as I was coming off of the psychiatric drugs.
And Laura, how long did it take from when you started the withdrawal process to when you actually started to make a turnaround and started to feel better?
I would say that the first 2 to 3 months it was hard to get out of the house. It was really painful and intense. And so in that time, things kept getting worse. In the first 6 to 8 months, though, at about 8 months, I actually started to feel better, a little bit of a shift towards the positive. I felt a little lighter, a little less anxious, a little more motivated, more energy. And, I'm almost 2 years into the withdrawal now. And I would definitely say that it's really been in the last 6 months, about a year and a half in, that I've actually started to feel good.
Mm-hmm. So especially with the long-term benzodiazepine addiction, to be prepared for many months of potential pretty serious withdrawal process. And what are some of the other kinds of advice that you think is important to really give people? I mean, you had the support of a doctor. And what if people don't have the support of a doctor, for example, and they just know that something's wrong with being on the medications?
Informing yourself about the fact that while it is really helpful to have a doctor's support, it is not vital that you have doctor supervision to successfully come off of psychiatric drugs. The MIND study over in the UK that was done in the last few years says that a person is as likely to succeed in coming off psychiatric drugs without a doctor's supervision as they are with. I think what I say over and over to people is that if you are in the middle of intense withdrawal and you're full of pain of all types, emotional pain, physical pain, mental pain, it really helped me to view that pain as a sign of my body healing. Like my body and my mind were working so hard to heal themselves, and the pain was, evidence of that. And that helped me find meaning in the experience, and it helped me feel like I could keep going. Because when I had moments of doubt, just like, I don't know if I can do this, I don't know if I can handle this, like, I think, what if I have to go back on the medications? I would remind myself that it was so important to me to find out who I was off of these drugs that I'd been on for over 10 years. So just like really looking forward to that point ahead of actually looking in the mirror and knowing who I was.
Laura, if someone is listening to this interview now and they themselves are taking psychiatric medications and they're really starting to get curious, like, wow, maybe this is something I want to start exploring, what would be the first step for them in terms of approaching the whole question of reducing and coming off medications?
Getting yourself informed, picking up books like Robert Whitaker's Anatomy of an Epidemic, Joanna Moncrief's The Myth of the Chemical Cure, and, a great resource to turn to for support around the actual withdrawal process and also for getting access to this type of knowledge and information is the Harm Reduction Guide to Coming Off Psychiatric Drugs, written by Will Hall, put together by the Icarus Project. That is a really helpful piece of information that has tons of websites, books, important facts.
Yeah, the Harm Reduction Guide to Coming Off Psychiatric Drugs, published by the Icarus Project and in Freedom Center, is actually coming out in its second edition now, so it's available in a revised and updated second edition. Laura, I want to really thank you for joining us on Madness Radio. Why don't you give us information on how people can get in touch with you and also about your blog, and if they want to find out more information?
If you want to contact me, you can find me at madinamerica.com. I'm listed under the bloggers, and my email address is there if you want to shoot me an email. I'd be more than happy to communicate with anyone who has any questions or who wants to hear more, or to direct you in the right direction. And I wish you all out there thinking about this, the best of luck. And I have faith in you, because it is possible. It is possible to come off psychiatric drugs successfully.
Laura Delano, thank you for joining us on Madness Radio.
Thank you, Will.
You've been listening to an interview with Laura Delano. She's a psychiatric survivor and activist diagnosed with bipolar at age 14, who was taking psychiatric medications for more than 10 years and has now been completely medication-free for 2 years. She's a peer specialist worker in a mental health agency in Massachusetts and a blogger on madinamerica.com. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Madness Radio is co-sponsored by peer-run support communities, Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Hosted by Will Hall, music producer is John Rice, with technical assistance from Jeremy Lanceman. Listen to our internet stream, podcasts, and show archives at madnessradio.net. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network, including KBOO in Oregon, WXOJ and WBCR in Massachusetts, Alaska's KWMD, and WPRR in Michigan. If you have an idea for a story or guest on Madness Radio, to help get us broadcast on a station near you, or if you just want to share what's in your head, contact radio@madnessradio.net.
And now the KBOO News at noon for Monday, February 1st, 2016. In local news, a Gresham Sam Barlow School Board Advisory Committee has proposed a $299 million bond measure to be placed on this year's November ballot. The bond would be the largest ever in the Gresham area and cost $742 per year for a home valued at $250,000. In 2013, a $210 million bond measure was defeated in Gresham by 16 percentage points. The 33-member committee visited all 18 schools in the district, met with community organizations, and commissioned two polls. The bond monies would be used to build two new schools, upgrade and expand classroom space in existing buildings, and improve heating and energy systems in all buildings throughout the school district. And more local news, the state's second largest company, Precision Cast Parts, was officially sold to Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway last week for $37 billion, making it the largest corporate takeover in Oregon history. Founded in 1953, Precision Cast Parts is America's largest